Case on this morning's call is number 03-1842, Roy D. Wiggins against Donald E. Gully. Mr. Nelson.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is David Nelson. I represent the plaintiffs in this Section 1983 action, Roy and Andrea Wiggins, who are father and daughter. This case has come a long way from where it started as an equipment violation in the Circuit Court of Saline County, or I should say numerous sequential equipment violations. It was filed initially in the same state court, which had heard the traffic citations, out of which it grew initially in the Circuit Court of Saline County, and then removed to federal court, because it was clear that otherwise the defendant in this case simply was never going to stop harassing the plaintiffs, no matter what the state court ruled on these citations. Judge Lockwood in the Circuit Court of Saline County could not have made it any clearer to Trooper Gully that, in his view, this statute was unconstitutional as applied to these vehicles belonging to the plaintiffs.
But the problem is, at least from our perspective, where we are bound by the record, this opinion of the state circuit court doesn't appear until September 28, 2001. I've looked at the August 20th order, and there's not a word about the federal constitution anywhere on that August 20th order. So even if we assumed favorably to you that Officer Gully was told about that order, all it says is motion to dismiss is granted, and then it goes on in handwriting, Trooper did not appear, motion is not resisted, motion to dismiss is granted. So Officer Gully, after September 28, 2001, personally never issued another ticket to either of the Wiggins drivers. I know you have a theory that there was a January 10 ticket only to Mr. Wiggins, not to Andrea, that was somehow under his influence or control. We can talk about that, but Officer Gully himself never wrote another ticket.
That's correct, Judge Wood. The record also contains, in addition to that rather cryptic docket entry that you referred to as to the August hearing, the transcript of the proceedings, the report of proceedings on August 20th is at A14.
Right, you put it in your appendix, and you can search that too, and you don't see anything that assures you that there was a ruling under the federal constitution, certainly not the part that you put in your brief. The judge is obviously annoyed with the fact that this keeps going on and the police officer won't take no for an answer and so on, and for all I know, it was prosecutorial discretion deciding not to bother these people with the tinted window rule. But Illinois did pass a statute saying even if you have vision problems, you can't solve them this way. You can't solve them by having a tinted window in a car manufactured after a certain date.
That constitutional issue, though, under both the Illinois and the United States Constitution, was squarely raised. That's what was presented in the motion that was before the judge on August 20th.
Yeah. Here's the problem. What evidence is there that Officer Gully knew that the Saline that Judge Lockwood had held the statute unconstitutional before he issued any citations? Mr. Gully knew the citations had been dismissed, but what evidence is there that he knew the judge had found it unconstitutional? That's the problem.
At this summary judgment stage of what we have, Judge Roldner, is the admittedly somewhat vague affidavit of the state's attorney in Saline County that he told Trooper Gully right after that hearing that it was dismissed.
But that doesn't tell him it was dismissed because the federal constitution was violated. That's a big step. I mean, is there any evidence? I sure couldn't find any in this record showing that Officer Gully knew that he was flouting an order of the state court based on the federal constitution.
Well, I'm not sure that's really central to my analysis, at least the approach that we take to this.
But a big part of your argument is that there was a definitive ruling by the state circuit court.
Yes.
About the constitutionality of this statute. And I'm telling you that August 20th order gives no hint that the federal constitution, as opposed to any of a number of other reasons why a state circuit court might dismiss a case, is the reason. September 28th, definitely yes. We see that, but the problem you have there is the timing problem that I said, which is simply that Officer Gully doesn't issue any more tickets.
I think what I was trying to say before is I don't think it's essential, Judge, that he have known at that point that it was based on the federal constitution. I think it was enough that he knew that the judge had so ruled.
Why?
That the judge had dismissed his charge.
I don't understand that unless you're trying to resurrect your class of one equal protection theory, in which case the record is really quite lacking in evidence that, for all I know, Officer Gully goes around issuing tickets to everybody with tinted windows. Maybe the tinted window man. You know, I don't know. How can we evaluate a class of one claim without this evidence?
As I try to say in the brief, Your Honor, what we think is at issue here is something that is so basic that we never address it. We barely ever address it, which is that nobody's above the law. Everybody has to follow the law. The court decides what the law is. The police officers have to obey it, and everybody wants to be an appellate court, but everybody wants to be the Supreme Court, maybe. But somebody has to decide, once a judge makes a decision on an issue that's in the jurisdiction of that court, then an officer of the law, like Officer Gully, has to obey that and follow that.
I don't disagree with that, but it seems to me that traffic violations like tinted windows might get dismissed for any number of reasons. And so until we get to that September 28th order, where we know that the reason rests on a very fundamental question about the law, and we don't need to discuss right at the moment whether that was right or wrong. Until then, for all Officer Gully knows, it might have been dismissed for a very circumstance-specific reason. Maybe there was a problem with the stop. You know, who knows? I mean, there are just 1,000 reasons why a traffic violation might be dismissed. And, I mean, Officer Gully wasn't in the courtroom. You know, maybe the judge thought that was part of the problem. I don't know. All I'm saying is I'm not sure what notice to Officer Gully one gets from just a dismissal.
Even granting your point, I think still after the September 28th order, there is still a basis for the plaintiff's lawsuit based on what the record on summary judgment shows as to the incident in which Officer Gully appears and encourages the probationary trooper to give him a citation.
Now, there was a third officer present who was actually the supervising officer.
That's correct, Officer Douglas. Yes.
Right.
Yes. And the depositions are all of record, as I know Your Honor knows, those inferences to be drawn from all that, it's our view, are factual matters for a finder of fact.
Could I take you somewhere just a wee bit different?
Yes.
Because irrespective of what Judge Lockwood said about the constitutionality of the state statute, didn't Judge Gilbert have an independent obligation at the federal court hearing, a claim for an alleged violation of the Wiggins federal rights, to determine whether the statute violates the Equal Protection Clause?
We don't think so, Judge Rosen.
See, I'm afraid that what you're saying is that the state courts have the authority to issue judgments that bind federal courts on the interpretation of federal constitutional rights. And we
That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm saying, and I tried to make clear in my brief, that we think that Judge Gilbert misconceived the particular equal protection argument that was being presented to him at that point. In the 1983 action, that didn't call on the district court judge to reassess what had happened below in the state court. It called on him and the jury, the case went on to trial, to determine whether or not the Equal Protection Clause was violated by Trooper Gully's refusal to abide by the determination of the court, of the state court. In other words, the plaintiffs.
So you're saying every time a state official, let's say, I'll be extreme, could be found in contempt of a state court, that automatically gives rise, in your view, to a 1983 action in federal court for violation of the Equal Protection Clause?
No, Your Honor, I'm not intending to
say that. Isn't that your argument? Because if the state court had actually issued an injunction against the police department of this area, which will assume encompassed the actions of Officer Gully, I can't imagine it would have enjoined him alone, so what's the point of that? But if it had done so, and if he had disregarded it, he then would have been in contempt of court, right? And it sounds to me like your argument is that automatically makes out a violation of 1983 under equal protection principles, which surely can't be right. The state courts are quite capable of enforcing their own orders.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't intend to suggest that. It's my brief.
Okay.
I suggest that. I will take my rebuttal time and thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. We'll hear now from Ms. Wunder.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
The grant of summary judgment should be affirmed because the plaintiff cannot show here that the officer deprived them of constitutional rights by issuing them traffic tickets for violating the tinted windows statute. One major flaw in the plaintiff's Fourth Amendment theory is the evidentiary flaw. They claim that Officer Gully knew or reasonably should have known that the Saline County Circuit Court declared the statute unconstitutional, and our position is consistent with some of the questions that have been raised here that draw out that there was no evidence that the officer, a reasonable officer, would have known that. And even backing up, there simply was no written order declaring the statute unconstitutional until September 28th of 2001. The docket entry that says motion to dismiss granted, officer did not appear, is not notice of the statute's being declared unconstitutional. And that leaves one ticket that was issued by a different officer, Officer White. The plaintiffs don't claim that Officer White lacked probable cause for that traffic stop. The stop was conducted before Officer Gully was ever even on the scene. And Officer White says that he decided to issue the ticket based on reviewing the statute and in discussion with his training officer.
Ms. Wunder, in your brief, you argued that the Wiggins hadn't properly notified the state of their constitutional objections to the statute pursuant to Illinois Supreme Court Rule 19.
Yes, we do.
How do you respond to their contention that the state was already present through the state's attorney?
The state was not a party to the state traffic court proceedings, the people of the state, represented by the state's attorney, were a party, and that is actually a significant distinction, because the state, qua state as an entity in its corporate capacity, the lawmaking body, was not a party. The Attorney General's office represents the state as the state, and the Attorney General's office was, of course, not notified of this decision. And Rule 19 places the obligation, notwithstanding the presence of the state's attorney, on the party raising the constitutional challenge. Now, as a practical matter, one would think that the state attorney's office would defend the constitutionality of the statute or notify the Attorney General's office, but that didn't happen here either.
I see.
And the state's attorney, under our state system, is a different, the state attorneys are different constitutional officers than the Attorney General.
I'm well aware of that. From my days way, way back, there was always a notification from the various state's attorney's offices when constitutional issues were being raised to the Attorney General's office. So,
and certainly that would have been appropriate, but
yeah,
the rule places the obligation on the party raising the challenge. And certainly nothing precluded the Wigginses from notifying the Attorney General's office, which would have resulted in an intervention, and then there would have been an appeal to the Illinois Supreme Court so we could get some authoritative controlling precedent and just have this issue resolved. But getting back to the evidence, there's the problem with there being no written order until September 28th, and then after that, even apart from that, there's just no evidence that the officer would have known at any time about the unconstitutionality ruling. What the officer knew was that one earlier ticket had resulted in a guilty finding. He didn't attend these later proceedings. He wasn't asked to attend the proceedings.
Was it one or two earlier proceedings that had resulted in at least some measure of compliance?
It was actually two. The first ticket resulted in just payment of a fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a ticket that was adjudicated, and Officer Gulley was informed by the state's attorney that that had resulted in a guilty finding.
No, that was the one. There was a very mild
yes,
one day's probation
court
and court supervision or something. But technically, at least, the statute had been applied and upheld.
And the circuit court decisions, of course, are not published orders, and no one informed Officer Gulley that the statute was declared unconstitutional. So he would have no way of knowing that.
Right. I mean, except that I suppose there's a different principle that also operates, which is within a particular matter, I'm thinking of the City of Birmingham case, within a particular matter, even if one thinks a lower court is wrong, one is obliged to follow what that lower court has done until, in the course of regular proceedings, a higher court overturns or modifies an injunctive order. The Supreme Court was quite clear in that case that it's not up to parties to decide, you know, whether somebody was right or wrong. So even though, of course, you're right about the circuit courts not being courts that create precedent in the same way that the Illinois Supreme Court does, on the other hand, it doesn't mean that when the circuit courts in Illinois issue orders that it's just a free-for-all and people can ignore them because it wasn't a precedential decision.
Well, I'm not suggesting that the order should have been ignored, and as a matter of good police practice, the order should have been followed and is being followed. But I am saying that there is no Fourth Amendment violation here, and if you put aside the fact that there would have to be a showing that the officer even knew of this, or
right,
reasonable
let's
officer,
just for the time being stipulate that.
Yes.
Even though
just from a legal perspective, it would not be a Fourth Amendment violation for the officer to continue to rely on the constitutionality of the statute despite one circuit court's ruling. That one circuit court's ruling would not negate probable cause.
Even as to this person and this, that's what troubles me. If the ruling were specific enough and it were, you know, okay, you, the police department of Harrisburg, Illinois, should not stop Roy Wiggins, because he has a medical, you know, get it specific. I don't see why a police officer would be entitled to just say, well, I'm going to keep stopping him anyway because I don't happen to agree with the order that the court in my area has issued. Why not take an appeal?
Well, the ruling is not directed to the police department, and the police department is not a party here. And had they been a party, there might be, you know, possible contempt sanctions or so.
Well, back when it was in the state court, it was the people.
The people were a party, not the police officer.
So I understand, but any order would have run to the department of which the police officer is a part through the corporate chain of command, I assume.
And why?
I'm just worried that you're telling me that anything Circuit Court of Saline County says can be utterly disregarded by the police department because the individual officers aren't named as parties.
It cannot be utterly disregarded by the police department as a matter of good law enforcement practice.
But you're saying it's not legally binding on them. They can just say, oh, we like bad law enforcement practice now, so we're just going to ignore.
Well, I would say the Fourth Amendment, from the Fourth Amendment perspective, there is no Fourth Amendment violation, and that is because Michigan versus DeFilippo explains that in order to negate probable cause, there must be some type of controlling precedent that establishes the statute's unconstitutionality. And circuit court decisions, even the circuit court in which they're issued, do not create controlling precedent. So lacking that, there's no Fourth Amendment violation. And that actually makes sense that you would need some type of authoritative judicial decision. When you're just looking at the Fourth Amendment, not whether there are other remedies available, because otherwise probable cause becomes a complete guess when there are conflicting circuit court determinations.
That's why I wanted to look at a different principle, because I have no quarrel, of course, with the one that you're naming, but it sounds to me like under this system, no matter how many times the circuit court said this and dismissed the case as to Mr. Wiggins, police officers in Harrisburg could arrest the Wigginses every day. They would be dismissed every day. They would therefore not be entitled to appeal and get this kind of ruling that you are describing because they were the prevailing party having secured a dismissal. The next day they get arrested again. It gets dismissed again. They can't take an appeal again. And somehow this all adds up to, I suppose, tough luck.
Well, in order to make an appeal, they could simply have notified the Attorney General's office, consistent with Rule 19, and there's no showing here of any sort of collusive effort to ensure that no appeal can ever be brought, which would be a very different situation.
But, of course, why would they want to notify the Attorney General's office? I mean, I realize they have an obligation to that, so I'm not serious, but the fact is, their obligation is to notify the office that will take a position contrary to the one that they're taking.
Yes, it is their obligation.
Right.
So because of the lack of any controlling precedent here, there is no Fourth Amendment violation as a legal matter. And even before we get there, there is no Fourth Amendment violation as a factual matter, because there's nothing in the record which would show that Officer Gully or a reasonable officer standing in his shoes would know until this lawsuit was filed, which was when Officer Gully and the Illinois State Police found out that the Saline County Circuit Court had declared the statute unconstitutional. And because the Fourth Amendment claim fails in both those respects, the summary judgment was proper. Even finding that a constitutional violation existed, the officer would be entitled to qualified immunity because certainly there's no clearly established law in this area. And a reasonable officer could conclude that despite the determination of one circuit court, since circuit courts do not resolve the constitutionality of statutes, that's not their role, he could continue to rely on the statute's constitutionality. And I'm not suggesting that continuing to give tickets would be good police practice. It's not what's happening now. There is a policy in place not to enforce the statute now that the district command is aware of the court's order, but there is no Fourth Amendment violation here. And I will conclude unless the court has any additional questions.
Thank you, Ms. Wunder. You have 2 minutes, sir.
If I could, just to go back to the Rule 19, I think I've addressed that in the reply brief to the extent I'm able. Let me just repeat from the brief that if Rule 19 were to be interpreted as it has been raised for the first time in the appellee's brief here, then one would expect that there would have been a reported case somewhere along the line since 1986 or whenever it was instituted, applying it as counsel would have it be applied here, and there are none that I've been able to determine. I referred to Younger versus Harris in the brief because this is exactly that kind of case that they said back then was that they weren't talking about. This is the kind of case where threats to somebody's protected rights can't be eliminated by the defense of a single prosecution in a state court. The Wigginses tried to do everything right. They tried to they ultimately did the right thing and hired a lawyer, and they went into court and they presented their position to the judge, and he ruled on it, and they obtained a judgment of the court, and that was not appealed from. And nevertheless, they kept getting arrested and charged for the same offense. So the only thing that they could figure out to do was to go back to court and try to get an injunction. Now, it was very unclear to me in Judge Gilbert's order that the footnote in which he's referring to injunctive relief in there. Clearly, injunctive relief is available in a situation like this.
I think he was talking about something different. I think he was saying if the state court had issued an injunction, it wouldn't have been up to him to enforce it. I don't think he was addressing whether a federal court could issue an injunction.
And of course, so far as the qualified immunity issue goes, that would not have anything to do with the injunctive relief. So far as it is being followed, the statement that it is now being followed by the Illinois State Police in the district in question, that's because the commander did issue a directive for the pendency of the litigation. I mean, there's nothing to indicates that there's no assurance that the Wigginses have that if this case is decided against them, this whole process will not start over again. And if I could just, the red light is on, if I could say another sentence, the Homola case that I cited in the brief out of this circuit says the judicial system can't tolerate litigants who refuse to accept adverse decisions. And I think that applies at least as much and probably more so to a public officer who refuses to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. The court expresses its thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.